today you would have been sharp eyed among you, the advantage is that although we add that this is three seekers, there are only two. And I think I owe you an explanation. The reason is something called a general election. There's a third seeker in the hall, is until tomorrow at MP, and is obviously already campaigning at the time. She has withdrawn, Catherine West. She's very sorry she can't be with us, but I have told her other two speakers it gives them another 5 minutes each to develop their theme, so I'm sure they're not too disappointed. We have two excellent speakers today. The first on my right is George Magnus, who is an associate of the China Centre at Oxford University, a research associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies. He's former chief economist of UBS. He's written extensively about China. He is the author of a book called Red Flag, which, as you can see on a table over there, Red Flag, Why Xi's China is in Jeopardy. If anybody would like to buy a book, I'm sure that he's ready to sign it for you afterwards, and would be delighted to do so. And on my left, the second speaker is Charles Parton, I believe, who spent 22 years of his 37-year diplomatic career working in and around China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. His final PhD, he was seconded to the EU delegation in Beijing, where as first counselor until late 2016, he focused on Chinese politics and internal developments and advised the EU and member states on how China's politics might affect their interests. He has had a very full diplomatic career as well. I'm not going to go into all the detail of that because he'd be here for a very long time. He is a trustee of China Dialogue, an NGO which focuses on China's environmental issues. And he was, but he returned to Beijing for 4 months as advisor to the British Embassy to cover the Communist Party's 19th Congress. So we have two very eminent speakers here today. I'm going to ask them each to speak for a quarter of an hour, and then I will open it up to the floor as you would want to explain what's happening there. So to start with, your members.
Thank you. thank you very much, and very good afternoon it is. We're talking really about whether sort of the good story or the good narrative about China can continue. In the book, actually, I have a chapter which is called The End of Extrapolation. It's sort of situated between a little bit of economic and political history of China and what I regard as contemporary China's principal economic and political challenges, looking into the future, and whether Xi Jinping's China actually is, or how well it is equipped to deal with those problems. So the end of extrapolation really is about my view, which is that we can't really think about China in the future as we used to think about it in the past, because something pretty important happened in 2012 when Xi Jinping came to power. So one of the most widely commented upon parts of the extrapolative process, which has become part of a narrative, really is that China's economic rise is unstoppable, and it's only a question of time now, if you do the maths on a spreadsheet, that China's economy will become the biggest of the world by 2028 or 2029 or 2030 or whatever it is. And my contention is that need not necessarily happen at all, for reasons which I'm going to try and summarize briefly here, but of course which are explained at length in the book. So as we look at China today, or right now for example, it is engaged in a sustained economic slowdown from the very lofty rates of expansion which prevailed for longer than any other country for which we have historical data. It was always going to happen at some point, but it is actually happening now. Part of it is self-inflicted, because after a kind of financial crisis that befell China in 2015-2016, the government quite rightly took it upon itself to say, you know, we will not have any truck with the kind of egregious forms of risk-taking and financial misbehavior for which it had experienced before. In this sense, Chinese financial or the financial system in China behaved very little differently from the way that ours did in the late 2000s, and for which we still are paying a very heavy price, as you know. So part of it is self-inflicted because they don't want to encourage this kind of credit boom and financial reckless behavior anymore. And part of it is structural. It's structural because, or reflecting, I think, three huge changes that have taken place in China during the last decades, but which have currently come to a head. They've generated their own kind of dynamic for the future. The first is that for many, many years, China was, at least from the rest of the world's standpoint, was a very hungry customer for Western products. And then it added on to that, or bolted on to that, its capacity to become a very feisty competitor. First of all, in low-value goods, I mean, for want of a better phrase, toys and textiles, but increasingly of late in high-value products, technology, for which we read about China's prowess and expertise all the time. But on top of that, of course, as you know, China is now regarded as an adversary by the United States in the EU's parlance, in the wake of the EU-China dialogue document, which was produced by Brussels earlier this year. China has become a strategic rival. Last year, around this time, it was regarded as something like a systemic competitor or something like that. But this year, the language has changed, and there is a kind of a it reflects a kind of the friction of which you are well aware that exists between the West and China in a number of different regards. So, this kind of more hostile external environment for China is certainly something which is having an effect on its dynamism. The second big change that happened is that for many, many years after Deng Xiaoping came to power in 1978, China was guided by a mantra or a slogan that has survived to this day. The slogan is reform and opening up, and it sounds very kind of rolls off the tongue, but nobody really knows what it means. But it actually was absolutely critical in encouraging what we have come to know as the eruption in China's economy. So if you think about some of the things that really kind of took off for China, the privatization of industry in the 1990s, when a lot of state-owned enterprises were sold off to private buyers, when small, medium-sized enterprise companies really began to take off. The much understated privatization of the housing market in the 1990s and the 2000s in particular is, I always regard as the thought of the third and much understated leg of a stool. Everybody knows about WTO, which China joined in 2001, and everybody knows about the industrial reforms that were taken in the 1990s. But the housing market, actually, in China, which used to be a housing welfare system, really, became a real market in the full sense of the word, and reflects incredibly well, really, on the capacity of the Communist Party in the past to have acted with great, obviously not only from self-interest, but also in a very kind of pragmatic way. The other huge change that happened under the party's kind of direction, really, was the revolution that took place in transportation. It's still happening to this day with high-speed rail, for example. And the investment, huge investment in transportation, and the reduction in transportation costs has really been like a kind of a mini globalization within China. So one of the things that has driven globalization, both at the end of the 19th century and, of course, more recently, has been the ease of transportation around the world and the reduction in the cost associated. But, of course, China's a huge economy, and actually opening up that economy and integrating its own single market, if you want, has also been a huge benefit to China. But this process of reform and opening up, even though the slogan continues to exist, is not really manifest anymore in the policies of the government, at least not in the sense that it was over the last 30 or 40 years. This doesn't mean to say that change isn't taking place. There's a lot of change taking place in China, bureaucratic change, administrative change, regulatory change, but not the what the Chinese call marketization, which is the incorporation of market type of mechanisms into the state economy, and not the liberalization, both of which marked out the policies and the stance of the government over many, many years. But this has changed under Xi Jinping's government because they've become more anxious and concerned about certainly discipline within the party, the role of the party, the centralization of power around the president and the party. And so this has given rise to a different sort of policy environment in which will have huge implications, I think, for the future, because I think the capacity to realize a lot of the aspirations which still exist for getting better off and rising living standards and solving fundamental problems will be affected by this change in governance. And governance is the third big thing that changed. So I said just now a little bit about how the party had earned its reputation for pragmatism and for managing change well. This was an abiding theme, with one kind of exception. Obviously, there was obviously the period between 1989 and 1992, as you know, which was bookmarked really by the Tiananmen Square protests at the beginning, and then Deng Xiaoping's so-called Southern Tour, which relaunched the reform initiative in China in 1992. But either side of this period, the process of managing change well was a hallmark of Chinese policymaking. And I think that this kind of shift towards a more controlling, more autocratic, more repressive, more centralized system of government in which the party is ubiquitous in economic, social, political, financial, and cultural affairs is something which, I mean, it's a choice. Obviously, countries make their own choices for what they want to do. But I think the economic consequences of this for China are not necessarily positive. And so we see in China today many of the features of economies that we've looked at in the past that didn't actually work out that well. And I think here about pre-war Germany and post-war Soviet Union and Japan, for example, in the 1990s and since. So amongst these features are a tendency to overestimate economic growth, the misallocation of capital and credit because of the investment rate, for example, in China is higher than in any other country in the world, past or present. And the way in which this kind of investment has been funded, particularly in terms of infrastructure and state enterprises, has been through the rapid accumulation of debt. The debt capacity of borrowers is actually starting to kind of creak a bit. So a lot of borrowers have to basically borrow money in order to stay current with their interest payments. And the banking system is vulnerable, not necessarily because people think that major banks are going to go bust as the way they did in 2007, 2008 here and in the United States and elsewhere, but because banks usually get into trouble, not because they make bad loans. I mean, that affects their profitability and it affects the efficiency of the economy. But banks get into trouble when they become illiquid. They just run out of deposits. So most banks basically get deposits from you and me and from corporations. They're usually quite stable. Banks know how to manage these deposits. They know when the withdrawals become very high and when the kind of cycles tend to ebb. What central banks are not so good at doing is anticipating how banks' deposits change when they are reliant on very short-term interbank, overnight, one-week maturity kind of funding. This is basically what caught us out in 2007, 2008. So Northern Rock, Bear Stearns, Lehman's, for example, were brought down not because they made bad loans, but because they became illiquid. And there have been three small banks in China that had to be rescued this year because they became illiquid. So the structure of their funding, in other words, is quite vulnerable. This is not the big five banks in China, which look to be pretty well managed, but the raft of smaller banks, which could be quite vulnerable to problems, and it basically speaks to one of the big challenges that China has in the near future, which is to manage over-indebtedness and to bring down its reliance on credit creation as a driver of growth. The second big challenge China has is poor demographics. So it's the fastest aging country on the planet, not the oldest, which is Japan, but it's aging faster than anybody else. So China will age in the next 20 years faster than the Western world has done over almost a century. This is nothing to do with the one-child policy, by the way. It has to do with other reasons that have basically compressed the birth rate. And, of course, like everybody else, China has a growing cohort of over-60s and over-65s. There are ways of mitigating this problem for China, as there are in other countries as well. But the key problem is that you have to basically recognize that there's an issue and actually try to mitigate those circumstances by different kinds of policies than certainly are being pursued at the moment. So it's this kind of drop in the working age population, which is relentless for as far out as you care to predict, which is going to compromise China's growth as well. Three other things which I'll just finish on. Firstly, high income inequality in China is also as big a problem for them as it is for the Western world. It's a problem which the government really needs to try to get its get a grip on. It kind of lives and breathes the reduction in poverty, which is a mantra, a national priority, and at which they've been extremely successful in bringing people out of poverty, decimating the poverty rate over the last 20 years, in fact. But income inequality between urban and regional areas and even within the urban labour force is a big problem. Getting scientific and technological prowess to basically get into the boring bits of the economy, which is basically the key to avoiding what economists call the middle income trap, is also a very, very important priority, or should be, for the government. And we do have this kind of tension between China's great achievements in terms of battery technology and electric vehicles and artificial intelligence and all of that kind of digital world, really. But actually, there is a sort of a conflict or a tension between the scientific and engineering accomplishments and actually getting it to basically plant roots and permeate the bits of the economy which will deliver the productivity which it has found lacking in recent years. Not unlike us, I would say. It's a common problem. And then, finally, the trade war, which is really, as you know, I mean, it is about soya beans and about liquefied natural gas and about aircraft and about all the things that the United States and China are talking about at the moment, and may well reach, in fact, a quote, deal, unquote, to be signed somewhere. But the trade war really is much more than about just trade. It's about technology, it's about industrial policy, it's about standards and beliefs, and it's about an adversarial relationship which needs a new kind of engagement in order to basically stop it from basically having undesired and unpredictable consequences that reach beyond commerce. So the American thinker Edward Luttwak, not perhaps one of the most widely known thinkers, but actually he wrote very cogently in the 2000s about the trade war that the Americans had with Japan and Western Europe in the 1970s. And he talked about that situation as being the language of conflict, the language of conflict in the grammar of commerce, which I thought was kind of a very apt description for what is going on today. It is a conflict. I mean, it's a commercial conflict, but it underlying that conflict is very, very kind of deep-seated issues of completely different understanding about what industrial technology policy is about, and the issues of national security, which both sides are actually imposing on companies, but obviously in an arbitrary sense, and not really according to sort of a book of rules, as it were, which was how governance seemed to take place for most of the post-Second World War period. And it's this kind of much more uncertain, unpredictable world, which I think is something for which there will be no winners, unlike President Trump, who thinks that there are winners in a trade war. There are no winners in a trade war. And unfortunately, the problem is who can inflict more damage on the opponent than they do on you. So it's a source of great concern, I think, and great concern for both sides, but obviously for China, which is a poorer country and has great aspirations. I think it's a big issue, and it's having not only an effect on the economy, but having an effect on companies in China that flocked there, as you know, during the last 20 or 30 years, and many of whom are now looking to other countries in Asia, Korea, Japan, even Malaysia, Vietnam, Cambodia, to relocate at least some of their supply chain operations so that they can avoid being trapped by this phenomenon, which I think probably looks set to continue for some time. So Red Flags basically is really about contemporary China and the challenges it faces in the future and why the narrative may not be everything that you've been told it is. Thank you.
Thank you. So the exam question is the long success story over? And I'm going to jump straight ahead to 2049 because that is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China and is the second centennial goal of Xi Jinping, who declares that by that stage China will be the superpower. He doesn't put it quite like that, but that's the intent of what he says. And my contention is that it won't be the superpower, and I don't even think it will be a superpower, although it will be a power. The reason for that is many, but I think we should start, first of all, that if you wish to be a superpower, you have to have a sustainable economy. George has talked a lot about that. I won't go into great detail, but just one sort of fact. Currently, China's GDP, I ignore, but its income per capita is $10,000. The Americans are $60,000. For China to grow between now and 2049 to match current American standards, it must grow at over 6% per year. I don't think that's going to happen. And in terms of its long-term strength, China has got an awful lot of expenses in that period to foot. A social security system, which is still only embryonic, is going to cost an awful lot of money. A domestic control and repression system. Environmental problems, enormous expense. Even the expenses of Belt and Road, if it's not got right, could be enormous, to say nothing of the PLA and its navy and that sort of expansion. So a vast amount of expenditure is going to happen. And there are four very serious problems. George has alluded to the debt and the demographics. I always beat George over the head because he never mentions the environment, which is probably more of a problem, I think, in the longer term. And the biggest one of all is the water crisis in the north of China, which I think is going to have far more political and economic effects and instability than perhaps the others. I could go into that in great detail, should you wish. But those four problems are the ones that stick in my mind. And in order to deal with them, you need a governance system that is capable of it. And for all that Xi Jinping tries, as one of his ways of legitimizing the rule, the monopoly of power by the party, for all that he says that the Communist Party is the best form of governance, I have my doubts. On five grounds. Firstly, as Leninists, a good Leninist will never let go of the economic levers, because once you do that, economic interests arise, and back in my mind, somewhere from school, there's the expression, no taxation without representation. These people tend to form parties, and because money is power. The party, the Communist Party, never allows any other organization to take up, and that's why when we talk about when Xi Jinping talks about the third Third Plenum, 2013, talks about the market playing the decisive role in the allocation of resources. That's a slogan. It is not what's happening. And if you look at the reforms of the state sector and the travails of the private sector, I think you can see that, because they simply cannot afford to let go of those levers of control. Secondly, the party dodges tough decisions. I mean, we always hear about the Communist Party can do things that democracies can't. Well, sometimes it's true. If you want to move 340,000 people to make way for the South-North Water Transfer Project, you can do it in China, which you probably have much more difficulty here. But take an example, for instance, like raising the pension age, which is, you know, given what George has said about demographics, is highly important. The party's been looking at that for as long as I can remember. And it hasn't done it. Danny Alexander managed it, as Secretary of Treasury, managed it in a couple of years here. So the party dodges tough decisions. Thirdly, it's a top-down organisation. It's all about inspection and command. There's very little self-regulation within the party. It's not a system that can self-regulate. What happens, you know, Xi Jinping has basically gotten rid of four, I think, key allies in moving forward such a complex and enormous economy of China, because you can't simply, as the party, keep inspecting and telling people what to do. And those key allies are, first of all, freedom of the press. It's incredibly important, since you can't do it all yourself, to have an independent press doing investigative journalism, pointing out where things aren't going according to the right policies. Secondly, he's basically put an end to the development of civil society. Civil society is very useful for governments in terms of the pressure it brings to bear and the ideas that come from it. Civil society is terribly dangerous. Imagine having an NGOs getting together and forming a Green Party. I mean, you'd have the Chinese equivalent of Miss Lucas. That can't be allowed. It would be dangerous to the party's control of power. So, fourthly, an independent judiciary. When things go wrong, you actually don't want the party to be able to involve itself in judicial decisions. That's a large part of what lies behind, for instance, an inability to impose decent environmental standards, because those who have power can get round the judiciary. So that's incredibly important. And finally, some form of political accountability. It doesn't have to be Westminster-style democracy. But if a party secretary or a mayor knows that if he doesn't deliver the goods, he's out, no matter what his political relations are, I'm sure that would bring a lot more accountability into the system. So that's my third ground. The fourth ground is actually an inability to implement. If you spend your life, as I do, reading Chinese documents and speeches, etc., you will see that in the last 7 or 8 years, Xi Jinping has spent his time railing or cajoling the people who really have power in China. And those are the 2,851 county party secretaries, in my view, the most important and powerful bloc. And finally, fifthly, and here I'm on less sure grounds, is whether China is actually able to innovate and create. Now, of course, if you put a lot of resources into, just as the Russians did, you will be able to send people to the moon prepare very effective weapons. I don't deny that. And China has actually been quite creative and innovative in the last few years, particularly when it comes to facing the consumer. But with the increasing control of the party on private enterprise, I have severe doubts as to whether the likes of Tencent, Huawei, or Alibaba can actually arise. And when people talk about the China model and they compare it with India, there's a very good paper by Huang Yisheng, who's an American Chinese descent economist, who said, don't compare the China model with the Indian model. That's meaningless. Compare the China model within China. And the places that have done the best, Zhejiang and Shenzhen, have done so where the party's control is the least. And those where it is heaviest have done less well. And that's why Hangzhou has so much industry, because Shanghai turned people down because it was the party trying to control things. So I think that governance model makes me very pessimistic that China is able to deal with the problems that George identified, although, George, please, environment and water. And then there's a sixth thing which George alluded to, that I think the world is now changing in its attitudes. The EU, 28 countries have managed to agree that China is a strategic competitor and a systemic rival. That's a big change. I won't mention the D word, decoupling, but convergence is definitely giving way to divergence. I think we need to recognise that. If you look at the systems, political, economic and value systems, they are all diverging in the last 10 years, whereas they were converging perhaps in the first 30 years of China reform. And I don't need to go into detail of that, other than to say that in terms of values, of course, Hong Kong is where the tectonic plates meet between liberal democracies and China, and what's happening in Xinjiang with the million people in concentration camps is another one. These things are really beginning to have an effect. And that divergence is pushed by technology. We're in a completely different world now. Huawei is merely the front runner of this. There are many other changes and challenges coming down the line, like quantum computing or graphene technologies, etc. So getting this decision on Huawei is intensely important, if only because it means we have to take into account what's coming down further down the line. And the biggest challenge of all is not so much things like Huawei. Huawei is only a small part of it. But I do urge people to read a fantastic paper which came out in the last 2 weeks by a young American academic, Samantha Hoffman, on engineering global consent, it's called. And in that, she takes one company, which is has a translation. It translates 65 different languages. And its software is embedded all around the world. And every single piece of information that gets translated is sent back to China. So that's, if my memory serves me right, about 4 petabytes, which is 20 billion Facebook photographs each year. And using that information on its own websites and its own publicity, it boasts that it makes instruments of use to the People's Liberation Army, the Ministry of State Security, and the Ministry of Public Security. And it also quite rightly says that 95% of intelligence is open source. And what it's doing, it's just merely one company, which belongs to the Central Propaganda Department, incidentally, hoovering up all this information, which, with AI, is going to become a very, very great challenge to us. So, there is the divergence coming, and it's not just the USA or even the EU. China, too, perceives this. If you read Xi Jinping's speech, his very first speech, the Politburo in 2013, which was published this year, he talks about an existential struggle between the Chinese socialist system and the Western capitalist system. If you look at the first moves in this divergence, a different form of internet and internet governance, that's China, that's not the West. And indeed on demands on our companies to put all our information in our servers, in other words, to be completely transparent, but those within China and accessible to the Chinese authorities. These are areas of a divergence which come from China. And if I may mention the younger cousin of divergence, and of course in China cousins will disappear if you only have one child, but reciprocity. If you look at the question of reciprocity, would Beijing allow foreign companies into its 5G systems? Of course not. Probably very wisely. But then why should it demand that we do? So divergence is coming. I'm running out of time. I would just mention what I see to be probably the 5 or 6 biggest areas in our foreign relations with China that we will have to deal with over the next 10 years. Firstly, it is managing that divergence which I talked about. Because we do want good relations with China, and we must minimise the consequences of that divergence without ignoring it. And that requires us to put our national security first, our interests first, and our values first, just as China does the same. Secondly, I think this question of technological spillover, which I referred to in terms of that paper on information being taken back to China and used, I think we're going to have to decide what we do about big data, the extent to which we allow it to go back to China, the extent to which we can stop it going back to China. Thirdly, I think the question of interference has bubbled right up the political agenda. I wrote a paper on this for Lucy in February. It sets out merely a framework for what is happening in 7 different areas. But I think we're going to have to look very carefully, and people are now. I noticed in the last few weeks a number of articles on academic freedom and interference in that. But even more importantly, it would be things like how we deal with research and development. Which areas do we wish to work with China on? Because we do. That's the benefit of both of us. Which areas must we steer clear of? And the degree to which we allow researchers from People's Liberation Army organisations, institutes connected with the PLA to indulge help in our research, in our universities is something we're going to have to deal with. And I think that further down the line, we're going to have to think much more carefully about competition for resources. whether that's food and buying up land worldwide, water. I was reading something even this morning from 2010 about a company buying up large tracts of Japan for the water, and the Japanese having no law to deal with it at that time, and energy. And lastly, the military threat. Where's that going to go? I think everyone talks about Taiwan and that. I don't believe China will ever invade Taiwan, certainly not in my lifetime, but we could talk about that. But nevertheless, the build-up of the PLA abroad is something that we are going to have to think about and deal with. So, in conclusion, is the long success story over? I think that 2020 is probably the high water mark of that, although the tide may not recede for a while yet. There used to be the view that with increasing prosperity, China would move towards a more liberal and more democratic system. That seems to be being well exposed, and anyone who espoused it says, well, I didn't think that, did I? But I will say that one thing I have always held is that if the Communist Party's system is maintained, then China will not be a superpower. That is something I have consistently held. Mr. Chairman, that's probably my time. If you wish me to talk about Hong Kong, I could, but I've run out of time.